It took years to conclude the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement. So, can Washington and Tehran now really do a deal in weeks? On a trip to China, Iran's foreign minister Abbas Araghchi talking up chances of an agreement with the Trump administration. His government's even hinted at an arms deal. This despite the absence of diplomatic relations between Tehran and Washington since the 1979 Iranian Revolution. What's next in the talks that resume Saturday in Oman? And should we be connecting the dots between U.S. negotiator Steve Witkoff's previous stopover in Moscow, where he'll be haggling with the Kremlin over Ukraine? After all, Russia's just ratified its strategic partnership deal with Iran. Are the two files separate? Or is this a two-for-one bargain by the Trump administration, which is angling for quick results? And then there's Trump's biggest allies in the region. Israel's as wary as ever, but this time the Saudis have muted their objections to a nuclear deal. So would it mean a safer region or a nuclear arms race? Today in the France 24 debate, we're wondering, could there be a deal in no time? Joining us from London, Sanam Vakil, director of the Middle East North Africa program at the think tank Chatham House. Good to see you. From Washington, Benam Bentaleblou, senior director of the Iran program at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies think tank. Thank you for joining us again.
Pleasure to be with you.
Former French ambassador to Saudi Arabia, Bertrand Besancenot, is with us. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
And Rina Bassiste, international correspondent for Israel Public Broadcasting Corporation and contributor to Al Monitor's Israel Pulse. Thanks for joining us.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
You can listen. That's right. Listen, like, and subscribe to the France 24 debate wherever podcasts are streamed. 2 weeks into these talks, and to hear the interested parties, negotiations in Oman and Rome are going swimmingly.
Well, talks with the United States is going in the right direction. It's still too soon to judge. We are cautiously optimistic, and if Americans continue to stay in a constructive way and avoid any unrealistic, undoable demands, I am confident that we can get to somewhere and we can conclude a good deal at the end.
Rina Bassiste, would you have thought on January 20th that you'd be hearing that from the Iranian foreign minister?
I think we were all surprised at a certain point that the Trump administration decided that it wants to go for a deal, because it was President Trump in his first mandate that went out of the 2015 deal. Now we are in a completely different situation. And of course, in Israel, if you remember at the time, there was much objection to the first deal. In Israel, they are also very worried about a potential second deal. And now we see that the second deal could take place, I don't know if within weeks, but maybe in the coming few months.
Ambassador Besancenot, how do you interpret the diplomatic ease that we heard there from the Iranian foreign minister? Oh,
frankly speaking, it is not completely a surprise, because President Trump has been very clear before, even in the campaign, that he was in favor of a diplomatic solution and not in favor of a confrontation in the region. And for very clear reason, on one hand, Iran is really weakened because of a difficult economic situation, because of the loss of its jokers, the Hamas and the Hezbollah, because of the disappearance, if I may say, of Bashar al-Assad, because of many different factors. So President Trump sees himself not as a warrior, but as a businessman, and he thinks that he can make a better deal than the JCPOA. So taking benefit from the fact that Iran is in a weakened position. Now, the problem is that, of course, the two sides, the position of the two countries are very far apart. When I hear what are the aims, or the supposed aims of the Americans and the Iranians, they are very far. On one hand, it is putting an end to the nuclear program, having very strict constraints on the ballistic atomic program, the Iranian one, and a complete stop of the activities of the Shiite militias. On the other hand, from the Iranian point of view, of course, they don't want to renounce their nuclear program. They say that it is only civilian, of course. And they don't want to renounce as well to the ballistic program they have. And if they look at what happened to Iraq, Libya, or Ukraine, they can think that renouncing their nuclear program, benefiting from so-called international security guarantees, doesn't work. So I don't think that the position of the two countries are close. They are very far. Now, it is true that the beginning of the discussion has been a smooth one, apparently. But even when you listen to what says the Iranian Minister of Foreign Affairs, he's very clear on the fact that he doesn't want to hear unrealistic demands, which means that for the Iranians, their aim is to discuss only the nuclear program and having the lifting of sanctions. On the American side, well, we will discuss that, what are the real aims and where they can go. But I think they are very far away. So it is on principles, on aims, they can discuss. But the outcome is very far from being clear.
The outcome is very far from being clear. Well, let's break this down. Benam Bentaleblou, what does the United States want?
Well, that really is the million-dollar question, because you've actually had a whole host of oscillating statements about what different, even explicitly diplomatic means that the administration could take to achieve the same stated political aim. Whether you're an internationalist or an isolationist serving in the Trump administration today, there are different options to achieve the end state that President Trump has himself said multiple times, but particularly since February 4, when he signed and published National Security Presidential Memorandum Number 2. You know, one flank, you know, you could particularly say is looking for a more limited monitoring and verification-based agreement. You've seen Steve Witkoff several times now. That's a special envoy. Mentioned this be the potential contours of a potential deal. Then you've seen other elements of the administration as well, be it the National Security Advisor, Mr. Waltz, or the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, talk about that larger disarmament or dismantlement kind of framework, frameworks of which, as the ambassador just mentioned, do exist in history. Some of them, like the Libyan model, Iranian Supreme Leader himself, for many years, for a decade plus, have taken to task now. But nonetheless, there are those examples, and they also do range in the realm of friendly countries as well, such as Taiwan in the history of counterproliferation. And the most important thing to take away from these more limited, be it direct or indirect engagements between the Americans and the Iranians is first and foremost that the Iranians have done an about-face. They fought the idea of negotiations with President Trump for quite a long time. So there is really a threat that they sense here. But the longer they may potentially engage, perhaps they may be hoping to get the U.S. to move from partially seeking dismantlement to fully seeking just arms control and limited monitoring and verification. And to that end, I'm reminded very much of an old quote by the former Iranian president, who about two decades back, when this nuclear crisis got underway, was a chief nuclear negotiator, and his name was President Rouhani. And when he campaigned in 2013 for the presidency, he talked about turning threats into opportunities. And as we're just waiting for seeing which one of these two paradigms or frameworks governs America's public and private position towards nuclear diplomacy with Tehran, we're also seeing how Tehran is using the negotiations in a drastically different way in 2025 than back in 2013 or in 2015.
Salem Vakil, what's your understanding? As you heard there from Benham, there are sort of two camps inside the Trump administration. But what's your understanding of what the United States sees as what would be a good deal, and how much or how little would it resemble the one that Donald Trump tore up in 2018?
Well, I think, as has been said, there's definitely a debate within the U.S. administration among the advisors of the president between the how broad and expansive a deal could be versus how narrow. I think it's important to remember that this is a second Trump administration that's come into office with a much more determination, loyalty, and focus. And this administration, unlike the last one, appears to be determined to deliver a deal, one that is perhaps a deal that the president is keen to see. And remember that on February 4th, when he did sign that National Security Presidential Memorandum Number 2, the president also undercut that memorandum by laying out his intention to seek a deal. And I think that was reflected in Iran's response. There was certainly an internal debate in Tehran about how to proceed. There was a clear lobbying effort with advisors around the Supreme Leader making a case that engagement, be it direct or indirect, would help the Islamic Republic mitigate against further sanctions that continue to come from Washington since the Trump administration has come into office. But secondly, to mitigate against Israel's pressure to attack Iran and attack Iran's nuclear facilities in this year and against the backdrop of perceived Iranian weakness. So Tehran's strategy is to build on this moment, and not unclear if they'll get to a deal in the 60-day timeline, but clearly there is some contour of negotiations that will be built out. Working groups are going to start meeting this weekend, and it's in those working group meetings that will focus on the nuclear aspects, but also the sanctions relief aspects that we'll see if progress will continue to be made. I certainly think both Tehran and Washington see this as a real clear opportunity and perhaps the only deal that President Trump could deliver in 2025.
And it's going so fast. 10 years ago, the UN brokered that joint comprehensive plan of action. It was signed after arduous negotiations between Iran. It was the five permanent members of the Security Council. There was Germany, the European Union as well, a process that had started in the late 1990s. And got to 2015. And an interview. So the question then is, we're wondering if in 60 days now, Sanam Vakil, there can be a deal. But there is a deadline looming. And that is that under this agreement signed a decade ago, there's what's called snapback sanctions. So the Iranians are under pressure to sign something fast.
Well, the Iranians are under pressure. Yes, you're quite right, because the snapback sanctions will expire in October of this year. And European countries, particularly the E3, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom, have used the pressure of snapback sanctions in this deadline to try to motivate and mobilize negotiations. Ironically, here, Europe has been cut out of these talks. Because ultimately, I think Tehran and Washington recognize that this is a bilateral process that requires international support. But the use of this snapback deadline is certainly important. And if enough progress is made, I think we could have a couple of scenarios. I'm not confident that a full deal can be arrived at in 2 months. I think there are a lot of technicalities that need to be ironed out. But certainly there could be an interim agreement that could buy them a bit more time. But I would also say that time is not on Tehran's side. The longer these deals and negotiations drag out, the more opportunity there will be for spoilers, be those opponents in Tehran or hardliners in Washington. And certainly Israel's campaign against this negotiation will certainly mount and could scuttle the negotiations.
Ben Talablu, you agree?
Actually, yes. Sanam mentioned that time is not on Tehran's side, and I strongly concur with that. You even see during the period between the first round in Muscat and the second round in Rome, the Trump administration do what the Obama administration and even what the Biden administration was unwilling to do, which is to actually escalate the most painful economic penalty, the oil sanctions, during rounds of talks. Sometimes that's seen as counterintuitive to the logic of building trust, but I don't think the Trump administration is potentially even looking to build trust here. I think they're looking to build leverage. So I concur that time is not on Tehran's side, and I also concur with Sanam that the framing of the way the E3 looks at snapback and treats snapback as the threat being a great motivator or driver of diplomacy really was there. But the problem is that going back to that same former Iranian president who was a former nuclear negotiator, again, when he campaigned, he said in Persian, "I will negotiate with the village chieftain." So way back more than a decade ago, the Iranians understood the bulk of their economic pain and the equities needed to be adjudicated directly with Washington itself. The problem is when you look at that history, particularly from a more hawkish perspective in Washington, you see that every time the Americans, the Iranians enter negotiations together, be it over nuclear or regional, direct or indirect, the Iranians often enter with a weak hand but leave with a strong hand. And it also would be a big shame for the Trump administration to ignore the European position here. That's not because they're transatlanticists or multilateralizers or whatnot, or that things are going so great on the tariff front or the Russia-Ukraine front. It's particularly because since the Trump administration left office, on three or four different vectors of the Iran threat, the European Union and the United Kingdom, as well as some other Five Eyes countries like the Canadians and the Australians and those in New Zealand, have actually significantly improved their pressure policy towards the Islamic Republic due to human rights violations, due to nuclear escalation, due to Iran's tightening military and political ties with Russia, for example, drone proliferation, you name it. And so for the Trump administration not to be able to capitalize on this change in the zeitgeist in Europe and, again, cut out important international partners, and then to kind of go to the front of your initial introduction, potentially even pave the way for a U.S. adversary to enter the talks, like the Russians, for example. You know, Iran's foreign minister prior to round two was in Moscow before coming to Rome, and prior to round three was in Beijing before going back to Muscat. So there is some cause for concern here, even though the macroeconomics of the case and time are on Washington's side. The politics of the situation and the ability to turn a threat into an opportunity, again, to borrow that phrase, might be on Tehran's side.
Yeah, Iran, Bertrand Besancenot, it's holding French nationals in what the president, Macron himself, has called hostage diplomacy. Why wouldn't Trump want to bring on side the French in this discussion?
Oh, I'm not sure that he wants that. For the time being, the negotiation, it is only between the Americans and the Iranians. At some point, it might be an interest of the American side to do so, but for the time being, it's not the case. And I'm not sure that the Iranians...
Wait, because Benham says it is in their interest and that he should be doing it.
Yes, but I'm not sure that the Iranians wants that as well. So for all those reasons, my feeling is that the negotiation will remain for a while between the Americans and the Iranians. But what has been said is very clear. The American position is still unclear. At some point, Mr. Witkoff said that Washington could live with 3%, 67% enrichment of the uranium rate. And then he said that but the whole enrichment process should stop. So it is still very unclear. On the Iranian side, I think that their position, in a way, is more easy to define. They can concede on some aspect, which is precisely the reduction of the rate of enrichment. And they also can promise, saying that we will ask our proxies to be quieter, but especially at a time where they are already in a bad position. So it's not major concessions. Now, also the Russians can take part of the high enriched uranium in Russia. So there are these elements that you can see. The problem is more on the American side, because if we go back to the 3.67%, it is exactly what we have already in the JCPOA. So I don't see how you can present it as a real success for this administration. When President Trump said that it was the worst agreement never negotiated, if the outcome is to come to exactly the same result, it doesn't work. And at the same time, there is the Israeli position, as this was said. I'm not sure that coming back to the JCPOA will be something that Mr. Netanyahu will accept easily. And there we come back to the military option, which President Trump has not excluded, saying that if the negotiation fails, we would have to consider it as well.
So. Yeah, and putting planes on standby in Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean. Last week, the New York Times was first to report that Israel had planned to strike Iranian nuclear sites as soon as next month, but was waved off by President Trump in favor of negotiations. Instead, Rina Basist, the U.S. president, had a phone call earlier this week with the Israeli prime minister over Truth Social. This is what he tweeted. "I've just spoken to Prime Minister of Israel, Bibi Netanyahu, relative to numerous subjects, including trade, Iran, etc. The call went very well. We're on the same side on every issue." They're on the same side on every issue?
No, I don't think so. I completely agree with the ambassador. First of all, we are not sure exactly where the Americans stand. It's not sure that they themselves decided. We have, on one hand, what Israel would have liked to see. Of course, Israel is talking about the Libyan model, a complete destruction of the whole Iranian nuclear program. We don't think that is going to happen. On the other side, we have what the Iranians would have loved to see, would love to see. Maybe we will see that. I don't know. Limitations, of course, on the enrichment, but maybe letting them continue to some extent, maybe letting them keep some of the already enriched uranium because they have quantities of uranium that was enriched to 60%, maybe letting them have a real civil nuclear program. And from the time being, from what we see, even though the American position is not so clear, what we can conclude from the little that is coming out is that it's going towards more the Iranian position than this idea of a Libyan model where there will be no more Iranian nuclear problems. So to say that Israel and the United States are on the same page, I don't think so. I think that Israel finds itself in a very, very complicated position for the moment. And that's why I'm not so sure that I agree with what has been said before, that time is not on Iran's side. I think Israel has little leverage at the moment. Once the Americans decided there is not going to be an Israeli strike in May, then what is Israel left with? If we remember the negotiations before the 2015 agreement, Israel tried to influence in two ways, because we were at the time of the Obama administration. So first of all, we had the Europeans, as the ambassador well recalled. We had France. And in a way, France represented at least some of the concerns of the Israelis security-wise.
Yeah, they were hawkish, more hawkish than the Americans.
More hawkish than Americans at the time of the negotiations. On the other side, since it was President Obama, who was not exactly friendly with the President with the Prime Minister Netanyahu, the Israeli premier at the time, if you remember, he went against against Obama. He went to the Senate and presented his case, bypassing Mr. Obama. Neither of these measures of actions are available to Israel at the moment because these negotiations are bilateral. The Europeans are out of the picture, so Israel cannot work with the Europeans to influence a future agreement. And Netanyahu also cannot go directly to confront President Trump. He cannot do what he did at the time against President Obama. He's in a different position.
Why does he have less sway? Why does he have less sway over Donald Trump than we thought?
I think because, first of all, even though he didn't say it very clearly, but all his associates said it very clearly when President Trump was campaigning, they were all on his side. They were all praying for President Trump to win again. He's perceived in Israel as the great friend of Israel. We saw also that he was the one that brought an agreement for the release of some hostages. So he has the interest of Israel in his heart, at least part of them. But America first. And first we see the American interest to reach an agreement, even though it's not, perhaps not, the interest of Israel.
All right. What's interesting is that you have an interview last week with French newspaper Le Monde, the UN nuclear watchdog's chief, Rafael Grossi, warning that Iran was not far from possessing a nuclear bomb, picking up on what he called in an interview with France 24. His team had mixed successes when they've been working with Tehran in recent years and trying to get them to cooperate. Sanam Vakil, again, it's the question of what leverage Iran has. How close to a bomb is Iran?
Well, we've certainly seen Iran advance considerably. Intelligence agencies, including the U.S. intelligence agency under the Trump administration, recently announced that Iran is perilously close, weeks and months away from being able to assemble a nuclear bomb. But of course, what Iran lacks is the delivery system of a nuclear weapon that we know of so far. And additionally, it's important to remember that weaponization isn't an easy process that can happen over hours. And the moment Iran does decide, should it decide to weaponize, that is, of course, a moment of great danger, because that's where a military strike could happen. But secondly, of course, that is where the regime might feel most secure and might feel that it has that security guarantee, but it also loses the leverage that it has acquired or believed to have built up since the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA in 2019. So this acquisition of nuclear capacity is what Iran is bargaining with the Trump administration over. It is looking to roll back its nuclear advancements in exchange for sanctions relief. So what we are going to see the two sides compromise over, and it's important to remember that these agreements generally see compromise on both sides, is the scale of the rollback for perhaps a lengthier deal. Who is going to oversee this program is why Rafael Grossi was on your channel, but also in Tehran, making a case for the IAEA's involvement. But above all, you know, what we are looking at here is the need for a sustainable deal, and a deal that has broader international buy-in, that also requires ultimately Israeli buy-in. Because if Israel is ultimately primarily focused on preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon, we also know intelligence agencies have said that an attack on Iran's nuclear infrastructure won't set Iran back permanently. It will only set Iran back for a period of time, a couple of months, if not a bit longer. And that would certainly, a strike of that magnitude, would certainly mobilize Iran to weaponization, something that Iran committed not to do in the JCPOA. You don't have to read the whole document. You just have to read the first page, where the commitment to not weaponize is written in black and white and signed by Iran, but also the international community. So it's important to weigh all of these issues as we look to the future, and also give negotiators a bit of time and space to deliberate and arrive at a negotiation that then can be assessed by the international community.
Benam Bentaleblou, the idea, because Israel hit Iran twice in 2024, the idea of strikes at this point, would that simply strengthen the regime in Tehran?
Oh, well, there is a lot there that Sanam just said, but let me just make one very respectful clarification. When it comes to assembling a nuclear weapon, and then certainly, Francois, your question about 2024 and its historicity, when it comes to assembling a nuclear weapon, yes, you need the fissile material, the delivery vehicle, and the weaponization or the fusing of that fissile material with the explosive material within the contours of a warhead. But when it comes to at least a ballistic missile, and you know, U.S. intelligence agencies have said for over two decades now, Iran is home to the largest ballistic missile arsenal in the Middle East today, well, for at least a decade of those two decades of reporting, they've also said Iran's most likely means of delivering a nuclear weapon would be a ballistic missile. And even earlier, they've said that Iran's ballistic missiles are inherently capable of delivering WMD. So even that Iran has only been refining the caliber of its medium range, both solid and liquid fuel, medium range ballistic missiles, they do have, unfortunately, the means with which to deliver them. And bringing us to 2024, you see that Iran actually engaged in two direct attacks against the Israeli territory, a really fundamental shift away from its security paradigm, which has been designed to eschew direct conflict so as not to have exactly what happened in response in April and in October, which is a direct attack on Iranian territory. So first and foremost, the level of risk-taking that we saw with the regime in 2024 is historic. You never had this during the Cold War, for example, between a nuclear and a non-nuclear armed country, particularly in the USSR or, again, the U.S. Camp, where not once, not twice, but three times a non-nuclear nation directly, overtly, and kinetically attacks the territory of a nuclear-armed nation, once Pakistan, January, twice Israel, once April, once October. So 2024 was exceptionally historic. If we're going to infer two things from Israel's responses to Iran's historic attacks, which were also historic. One, of course, is that Israeli creativity and military engineering really does pave the pathway here for more challenging of the conventional wisdom, whether that's the efficacy of a strike or, you know, Israeli military capacity. But second, I think that the Israelis can hit essentially any above-ground target in the Islamic Republic with relative ease, but with a high degree of training today. Why I say above ground target is because we have not seen any evidence yet that they could be able to hover in a sustained fashion over the territories or the targets that are underground or subterranean nuclear facilities, like one of them at Natanz and a much, much deeper one at Fordo. There's also in the press recently, since at least 2022, a much even deeper centrifuge construction facility that is allegedly not completed yet being built near Kuh Hakolang. So the Iranians are trying to tunnel to avoid being exposed to a more creative Israeli military option here.
Rina Bassist.
Yeah, this term of weaponization is very, very important here. Why? Because if you want to throw an atomic bomb at somebody, you need three things. You need the enrichment. And here we know that the Iranians have the capability, the capacity. They have 17,000 centrifuges. So it's just a matter of time. How long we let them to enrich? How far will they go? We have, and that was also mentioned, the part of how you throw the bomb. Of course, in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Americans used the airplanes, but we can assume the Iranians, if they have a plan to attack Israel, it's not with airplanes, because, of course, every Iranian airplane will be intercepted way, way before it arrives to any Israeli airspace. So it leaves us with the ballistic missiles. And we know that the Iranians have showed that they have the missiles, they can reach Israel. And that brings us to this last part of fabricating the bomb itself. And what Israel has always been afraid of is that when you talk about centrifuges, you talk about enormous sites that are very difficult to hide. Yes, you can hide them underground, but you cannot hide their existence. So we know that they are. We know they are big. We know that they are space-consuming. To weaponize, to create the technology for a bomb, that's something that you can do very secretly. All you need is a few labs here and there, people with computers, that's it. So this is something that is much more difficult to track. True, the Supreme Leader Khamenei has said that for the moment a decision has not been taken to take that step. And the assessment of most intelligence agencies is that they did not start yet, but we don't know that for sure. So this is the main concern of Israel, not from now, not from the beginning of these negotiations, but going years back. And the question is how much of that the Americans can stop, how much can they really bring guarantees that this will not happen if they let the Iranians to continue with some sort of enrichment, if they let them maybe to develop a civil nuclear project.
And on that point, Iran's not as isolated as it was 10 years ago. Both Benham and Bertrand Besancenot bring up the point that there's Russia this week ratifying its strategic partnership deal with Tehran. Russia, where Donald Trump's man of all mediations, Steve Witkoff, travels Thursday to talk about Ukraine before going on to Oman. But as The Guardian reports, Russia could also be a player in a nuclear deal. It's been touted as a possible destination for Iran's uranium stockpile and could also act as an arbiter of deal breaches.
We are ready to help, to mediate between the U.S. and Iran in negotiations, to play any role that, from Iran's perspective, would be useful and acceptable to the United States. We proceed from the understanding that the only possible agreement is one exclusively concerning nuclear matters.
Bertrand Besancenot, let's cut to the chase here. Is the reason that this real estate mogul, Steve Witkoff, is the mediator on both the Ukraine file and the Iran nuclear file because Donald Trump's a genius and he's going to use Russia to tie the two neatly together? Or is it because they're going in blind?
I think that the Russians are very much interested in becoming a mediator between Iran and the U.S. because, of course, it will show that they are now another big, big player in the world, that they are at parity with the United States. And also, they will try to find a deal because the deal will go as well on oil. We know, for example, that President Trump would love to see the price of oil going down because it will be against the inflation in the US. But at the same time, the Russians are very much interested in having a higher price of oil as the Gulf countries because they need it, one for the war in Ukraine, the other for their big programs. So there will be a kind of deal at some point between the two aspects. This is true. But at the end of the day, my personal
view... Is it a good idea to have the Russians be the ones that stockpile the enriched uranium or not, seen from a French perspective?
No, simply, I think that this is the only option that maybe the Iranian could accept, and that would be acceptable as well to the Americans. This is the possibility, because I don't see another place where this could happen. So this is the rationale. But at the end of the day, let us be clear, a lot will depend on what President Trump finds or feels as a success for himself or for the U.S. He has two main cards in his hand. The first one is that Israel depends largely on the U.S. Financially and in terms of weapons. On the other hand, the Iranians are desperate to have their assets defrozen and also to be able to start again to export their oil. So the question is that President Trump, will he be in a position to twist the arms of both the Israeli and the Iranians? I don't know, but he presents himself as the master of the deals. But when you look at what he did both for Gaza or for Ukraine, the outcome is not so clear. So the main uncertainty now is what will be, at the end of the day, the American position, and we are still there.
Let me ask you, Sanam Vakil, is it a stroke of genius on the part of Donald Trump to have the same man to be the mediator for Gaza, Iran, and Russia?
certainly wouldn't call it a stroke of genius, but I would say that there's something to be said for joining up negotiations that are, while distinct, have commonalities to them, and trying to leverage positivity in one discussion and connect it to another. Making Witkoff present and aware of the three distinct landscapes, I think, also helps him upskill quickly. He is someone with not a long history or background in Middle East conflict or Russian-Ukrainian history. So I think this helps with continuity above all, and oftentimes negotiators are siloed from conflicts that are interconnected. So it does speak to something that perhaps could be employed by other negotiators.
And Benam Bentaleblou, the fact that it's not a so-called expert who's in charge.
I think there's a kernel of truth to the potential desire for linkage, but I would say the simplest explanation, particularly in Washington, the Occam's razor approach is likely the truest or likeliest to hold, and that is, I think the administration needed someone who was politically loyal and socially saw these conflicts through the same transactional prism that I think we can rightly infer that the president does. And so I think that speaks volumes more than anything else here.
Rina Bassas?
No, I think it's very clear that... And that's very different than negotiations that were done in the past, that were done by experts. This time, the people that are leading the negotiations, what is their big virtue? Is that they are loyal to President Trump. That's why they are negotiating. They are loyal to President Trump, and they are loyal to his willingness to reach a deal. Is that a good thing? I'm not so sure. From the Israeli point of view, of course, there are concerns that a person that is negotiating both the deal with Russia and Ukraine and Iran and Gaza, I mean, it leaves very little space to any interests outside the American interests. So one could ask himself or herself, what is the end game here? If the end game here is really to reach an agreement very quickly, then, of course, it's the interest of Mr. Trump that he has the same person doing all three of these.
All right. When the 2015 JCPOA nuclear deal was signed, again, it was 10 years ago, neither Donald Trump nor Joe Biden was yet president. The agreement was squarely about one thing, nuclear nonproliferation.
In our time, the risk is that nuclear weapons will spread to more and more countries, particularly in the Middle East, the most volatile region in our world. Today, because America negotiated from a position of strength and principle, we have stopped the spread of nuclear weapons in this region.
With the negotiations that are going on, Sanam Vakil, are we closer or further away from nuclear proliferation in the Middle East?
Well, I think it's far too early to make these big calls. I think a deal is urgently needed to stem Iran's potential weaponization, but also for other countries to follow suit. And that's the big risk here. And this is why these negotiations should certainly be moving ahead, and hopefully a deal will be arrived at, but one that's long-term, that's sustainable, and one that locks Iran in from obtaining a weapon.
Bertrand Besancenot?
Arachi is an excellent negotiator, so this is a matter of concern.
Okay. That is, we'll leave on that thought. Many thanks, Ambassador Besancenot. I want to thank Rina Bassiste, Sanam Vakil for being with us from London, Benam Bentaleblou in Washington. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.